First Corinthians chapter 3. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Entitle this, if you're taking notes, Suicide, the Seriousness of Self-Destruction, Part 2. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Two verses, and we'll finish it up. Verses 16 and 17. Do you not know that you are the temple of God, and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? If any man destroys the temple of God, God will destroy him. For the temple of God is holy, and that is what you are. Verse 17, if any man destroys the temple of God, and that's not talking about a building, that is talking about your body. And God makes it very clear that suicide is a very serious thing, because God says, if any man destroys the temple of God, that is your body, God will destroy him. Turn over to Revelation chapter 9, and let me show you a passage that is seemingly unrelated, but you'll see the connection as I explain it. Revelation chapter 9, beginning at verse 1. This is a horrifying scene, and it will happen on the earth after the rapture, when you and I are taken to be with the Lord, and the tribulation breaks out upon the earth during that seven-year traumatic period of time. Listen to it. Incredible. Verse 1, Revelation 9. And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven which had fallen to the earth, and the key of the bottomless pit was given to him. And he opened the bottomless pit. That is where some of the most heinous, hideous demons are now chained in prison. And he opened the bottomless pit, and smoke went out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by the smoke of the pit. And out of the smoke came forth locusts, those are demons, upon the earth. And power was given them, as scorpions of the earth have power. And they were told that they should not hurt any of the grass of the earth, nor green thing, nor any tree, but only men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. Those are unsaved people. And they were not permitted to kill anyone, but to torment for 5 months. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings a man. Now hang on, keep reading. Verse 6. And in those days men will seek death and will not find it. They will long to die, and death flees from them. And the appearance of the locusts was like horses prepared for battle, and on their heads as it were crowns like gold, and their faces were like the faces of men, and they had hair like the hair of women, and their teeth were like the teeth of lions. Incredible sight, isn't it? Look at verse 10. And they have tails like scorpions and stings, and in their tails is power to hurt men for 5 months. Now here's verse 11. This is the punchline. They have as a king over them the angel of the abyss. Who is that? That would be who? Satan. They have as a king over them the angel of the abyss. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek he has the name Apollyon. The name Abaddon means one who destroys, or destruction. And the name Apollyon means destroyer. Satan is called in Hebrew and in Greek destroyer. He is bent upon one thing, destruction. And one of the greatest victories that he ever wins is the victory of suicide. Satan applauds every suicide that ever happens on the face of the earth. Suicide is the ultimate victory for Satan. When suicide takes place in the life of an unbeliever, Satan has won a victory, because when an unbeliever kills himself, the unbeliever causes his own soul to be damned in hell forever. And there is no possibility of repentance, and there is no possibility of salvation. His unsaved, unregenerate state becomes eternal the minute an unbeliever kills himself. Satan applauds it. Satan applauds the suicide of a Christian. Because whenever a Christian, and it happens, whenever a Christian kills himself, Satan has won a great victory, because when a Christian kills himself, it damages the reputation and the credibility of God. I mean, what kind of a God is it whose own people kill themselves, right? I've had people say to me, I can't wait to get to heaven. I want to be in heaven so bad, I am tempted to kill myself. That is foolish. That is ridiculous. So whenever a Christian kills himself, Satan has won a great victory. It damages the credibility of the whole message. What kind of a God is that whose own people can't even cope? They kill themselves. So you better understand who applauded suicide. Abaddon, Apollyon, the destroyer. And if he can tempt you to commit suicide, he will do it. About 3 years ago, I got a very shocking phone call. This was from a girl who at that time was in my youth group. She has a younger sister and a younger brother. A very loving mom, godly woman. But several years ago, for some reason, her mom and dad were fighting and couldn't get along, and her dad moved out. And her dad couldn't cope with the situation. And to relieve some of the pain, he turned to alcohol. And as he began to drink, he needed more and more and more to quench his thirst for alcohol, and he became an alcoholic. And one night he was in a terrible fit of depression. He was thinking about all that he had lost, his loving wife and his three lovely children, and he was at the bottom emotionally. And he reached for the bottle, the only answer that he knew. And he began to drink, and he drank himself into a drunken state, and in the midst of depression and completely drunk, he reached into a drawer near his bed and he pulled out a gun and he put it to his temple, point blank range, and pulled the trigger. And his daughter called me on the phone, weeping and sobbing, and asked me if I would do the funeral. I've done funerals now for two suicide victims. And it is not a pleasure, believe me. Not a pleasure at all. Let me give you the stats. I gave you some. Let me amplify them even more. 500,000 teenagers will attempt suicide this year. Now, I told you that, but I don't think it made the impact that I wanted it to make. So I got out a calculator, and I'm redefining it now. That works out to 54 suicide attempts among teenagers per hour in this country. 54 per hour. That means that in the time I'm talking to you, there will be approximately 47 suicide attempts among teenagers. That works out to just about one every minute. 5,000 teenagers succeed every year in this country. That works out to 13 suicides per day that are successful just among teenagers. Before you go to bed tonight, 13 teenagers in America will have killed themselves. Incredible. There is a saying that is true in the sports world, and it goes like this. No one will ever remember how you began. They will only remember how you ended. And that's true. No one will ever remember how you began. They will only remember how you ended. Demas had a great start. The Bible says of Demas, Paul called him my fellow laborer. But then the Bible says this of Demas, the last thing Paul ever said about him, Demas, having loved this evil age, has deserted me. And Demas will never be remembered for the great start, an associate of Paul. He'll only be remembered as a failure. AWOL. Blew it. Saul blew it. Saul had an incredible start. The Bible describes him in 1 Samuel as strikingly handsome. He was physically superior. He was unspeakably courageous. He was uncompromising. He was resolute in his convictions. He was a humble man, and the hand of God was upon him. But he ended up killing himself. And he is remembered now as a rebel, a liar, a jealous, bitter, murderous, pathetic man. And you can put any one of these three descriptions on his tombstone as an epitaph. 1 Samuel 28:7. Saul said this, seek for me a woman who is a medium. He will be remembered on his tombstone as a Satan worshiper. He wanted a medium. He will be remembered, 1 Samuel 26:21, as the man who, in his own words, has played the fool. He will be remembered throughout eternity as a fool. And he will be remembered, in the words of 1 Samuel 31, verse 4, as, quote, Saul, who took his own sword and fell on it. He will be remembered as a suicidal maniac. A man who had a great start. Judas, great start. Handpicked by Jesus Christ as one of the 12. Jesus only picked 12. Out of all of the people who were alive, he handpicked 12. And Judas was one of them. And not only was he handpicked as one of the 12, he was given all of the money. He was the treasurer of the band. And he had all of the money, incredible trust. But you read this of Judas, Matthew 27, verse 5. Judas went away and hanged himself. He will always be remembered as a traitor. Always. Nobody will remember how he began. They will only remember how he ended. And the same is true with you. And I might say to you, at your ripe old age of whatever you are, you have had a great start. You have been given a great start, but nobody is going to remember how you start. They will only remember how you end. And you can be sure that Satan would love, if he possibly can, to tempt you into the sin of suicide. Now, having said all of that, let me point out something that you may not realize. I know that physical suicide, killing yourself, putting a gun to your head, is a very rare occurrence. And realistically speaking, I think Satan realizes that for probably most all of you, there would not be any chance for him to tempt you to commit that sin. But it is important that you understand that there are four types of suicide. And physical suicide is just one type. And even though he may not be able to succeed in tempting you to commit physical suicide with a gun in your mouth, like the 17-year-old girl I described to you, or a gun to your head, as the father of the girl in my youth group, which I described to you, though he may not be able to tempt you to kill yourself physically, he will certainly be able to tempt you to kill yourself in three other ways. And if he succeeds in any or all of the three other ways, your end will be a disaster, and you will be remembered not for your start, but for the way you ended. So I think it's important that you and I get a grip on the other three forms of suicide. Don't you agree? We're talking about some pretty essential topics. Four forms of suicide. Physical is just one, but there are three other types. We need to talk about them. So get ready to write them down. And believe me, you commit any one of these forms of suicide, your end will be as disastrous as Saul or as Demas or as Judas. So pay very close attention. Let me give you a definition of suicide before I define those three other forms. What is suicide? Here it is. Suicide is the willful, violent, final act of self-destruction. Suicide is a willful, violent, final act of self-destruction. And you can self-destruct in four ways. Physical just being one of them. There are four ways to self-destruct. Willful, violent, final form of self-destruction. Physical being number one. Number two, moral suicide. Moral suicide. It is possible for you to willfully, violently, finally destroy yourself morally. I have seen it happen over and over and over again. And Satan would love to tempt you into committing a sin of such magnitude that morally speaking, it will destroy you. Let me show it to you. Proverbs chapter 6. Proverbs chapter 6. The book of Proverbs is God's book of wisdom. It is written as if a father is talking to his son. So as I read this to you, I want you to picture my 5-year-old boy on my lap and me as a loving father putting an arm around that kid and pleading with him about some very serious issues. And morality, or if you want that word even more precisely defined, sexuality is a very, very important subject. If you don't like the title moral suicide, then call it sexual suicide. You can destroy yourself sexually. Now here it is. Proverbs chapter 6, verse 25. And he's talking about the adulteress. Verse 24 makes that very clear, where he talks about the evil woman, the smooth tongue of the adulteress. What is an adulteress? An adulteress is a person who engages in a sex act with someone who is not their husband or wife. And this is what it says. Do not desire her beauty in your heart, nor let her catch you with her eyelids. For on account of a harlot, a prostitute, one is reduced to a loaf of bread. Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Answer that, can he? Can you reach into a barbecue and take a hot coal and hold it to your chest and not burn your clothes? No chance, right? Verse 28. Can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? No. Now, you've seen the gurus over in India do it. But I guarantee, stand on there long enough, you're going to smell the stench of burning flesh, right? So is one who goes into his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her will not go unpunished. Now why? Why is God so unfair here? Why is God prohibiting you and me from engaging in sex with someone who is not our husband or wife? Why does God say, I will punish you? It doesn't rightly seem fair, does it? I mean, God has allowed your body and mine to explode with hormonal desire for that thing. So why does God talk in such pointed terms? I will punish you if you do that. Is God a cosmic killjoy? Is he out to ruin your fun? Well, let's keep reading and we'll find out. Verse 30. Men do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy himself when he is hungry, but when he is found, he must repay sevenfold. He must give all the substance of his house. Now listen to verse 32. The one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense. God says you are stupid. You get involved in sex outside of marriage, you are stupid. You are a fool. You're lacking sense. Why? Last part of verse 32. He who would destroy himself does it. What happens if you engage in sex outside of marriage? You succeed in doing what to yourself? Destroying yourself. What is self-destruction if you put it in one word? Suicide. What happens if you engage in an immoral act? You have committed moral what? Or sexual what? Suicide. Will you mark it down? If you engage in sex outside of marriage, give it enough time, it will what? Destroy you. Now, some of you don't believe that. You don't believe it because you have friends who are in the locker room with you every week, and they dress next to you every week. And the whole time they are dressing next to you in the locker room, they are bragging about how macho they are because they were able to score on Friday night, and they give it to you in vivid detail. And they talk about the thrill and the pleasure and the goosebumps and the whole thing. And it is possible for you to listen to that and secretly in your heart envy that, because you're fighting the battle too. And all you hear about is the glory of it and the glamour of it and the excitement of it. But the problem that you have, you are at a very severe disadvantage being so young. And let me just tell it to you straight, all right? You are at a disadvantage being young because your perspective is very limited. All you see is your friend bragging about a Friday night deal and all the excitement that he generated from that. But because you are so young, you don't have the opportunity to observe his life over the long haul and see where he ends up 10 years from now because of the Friday night sin. I have that ability to perceive that, being a little bit older than you and having listened to those guys in the locker room talk that way to me and secretly in my heart, envying them. And secretly in my heart wondering, maybe I am missing the boat. Secretly wondering in my heart, maybe I am not allowing myself to enjoy legitimate pleasure. Maybe they're right. But I have had the benefit of watching their lives over the next several years. And I can tell you where they end up. And I would not trade my position with their position for all the money in the world. I mean, I've got friends who have contracted venereal disease because of that. I have friends who have experienced unwanted pregnancy because of that. Some of the girls with whom I went to school have to live for the rest of their lives, and they'll carry it to their grave, the guilt of murdering their unborn child because of that. And I have a whole lot of friends whose own marriages have fallen apart, and they aren't even allowed to see their own children because of that. Is it worth it? No chance. And so, yeah, I missed a few tingles on a Friday night. But in the long run, who came out ahead? Who came out ahead? When God says that you're a fool if you engage in that, you will destroy yourself, He's telling you the truth. Moral suicide. Turn over a page to chapter 7, verse 6. Again, picture my son on my lap, having an intimate talk with his daddy. And his daddy says this, "For at the window of my house I looked out through my lattice, and I saw among the naive, and I discerned among the youths, the young people, a young man lacking sense. Passing through the street near her corner, he takes the way to her house. In the twilight, in the evening, in the middle of the night, and in the darkness, and behold, a woman comes to meet him, dressed as a harlot and cunning of heart." How does a prostitute dress? In a very seductive manner, with perfumes, very attractive. Dressed as a harlot and cunning of heart. Verse 11. She is boisterous and rebellious. Her feet do not remain at home. She is now in the streets, now in the squares, and lurks by every corner. She seizes him and kisses him, and with a brazen face. That word means hard. Their gaze is piercing. They could melt butter if they look at it long enough. Maybe you have friends like that too. They don't blush. They know no shame. With brazen face, she says to him, "I was due to offer peace offerings today. Today I have paid my vows." Very religious girl. "Therefore I have come out to meet you, to seek your presence earnestly, and I have found you." She lied to the guy. "Want to go to church with you. I have spread my couch with coverings and colored linens of Egypt. I have sprinkled my bed with myrrh and aloes and cinnamon." Guy doesn't have a chance. "Come, let us drink our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with caresses." The man is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. He's taken a bag of money with him, and at full moon he will come home. And with her many persuasions, she entices him. And with her flattering lips, she seduces him. Now look at verse 22. "Suddenly he follows her, as an ox goes to the," what? "Slaughter." "Or as one in fetters to the discipline of a fool, until an arrow pierces through his liver, as a bird hastens to the snare, so he does not know that it will cost him his," what? "Life." Moral suicide. It'll kill you. It'll kill you. God's standard is very clear. Let me read it to you. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. I think you get the point, right? 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 3. "This is the will of God, your sanctification." Now, what does that word mean, sanctification? Listen. "This is the will of God, that is, that you abstain from sexual immorality." That is God's will. God's will is that you abstain from sexual immorality. God's will is that sex outside of marriage, no. Period. Now it goes on to say this, "that you know how to possess your body in sanctification and honor, not in lustful passion like the Gentiles who do not know God." Now listen to verse 6, very important word. "And that no man transgress or defraud his brother in this matter." What does the word defraud mean? The word defraud means to stir up in another person a sexual desire that they cannot righteously fulfill. Did you get that? The word defraud means to stir up in another person a desire for sex they cannot righteously fulfill. What is God's standard? Everything up to sexual intercourse, okay? No way. anything that would stir up a sexual desire, you've gone too far. That's where God draws the line. It isn't that you can touch and hug and kiss and caress and anything you want to do as long as you do not, quote, go all the way, you're okay. God doesn't draw the line there. God draws the line way back further than that. And God says if you touch a person in such a way as to stir up in you or in her a sexual desire, you have gone too far. Jesus put it this way in Matthew chapter 5. The whole thing of sex is like a hand grenade, and you play catch long enough with the thing, it's not long before it will explode. You stir up enough sexual desire, there will come a point when your desire will take over from your brain, and you lose the ability to control yourself. That's the problem. If you said, in all sincerity, I will not commit the act of sex, but I will do everything leading up to it. You are a fool, because you do everything leading up to it, you will commit the act itself. There comes a point of no return, where you are stirred up to the point where you can no longer stop it. That's why God draws the line back farther and says, don't stir up those desires, because you stir them up and up to a point, you reach that point, you can't stop it any longer. Believe me, there comes a point of no return. That's why Proverbs talks about it in terms of taking coal in your hand, holding it up to your chest. You're going to get burned. Now look at what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5, verse 27. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. Now Jesus is talking about the very thing I'm describing. Does that mean you can go all the way up to the act itself, and as long as you don't commit the act, you're okay? Jesus said, no. I say to you this, if you look on a woman to lust for her, what does lust mean? What is lust? A sexual desire you can't righteously fulfill. True? If you look on a woman in such a way as to arouse yourself sexually, you have already committed adultery with her in your heart. Now notice verse 29, very interesting. And if your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. It is better that you should have one of the parts of your body perish than the whole body be thrown to hell. And if your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off, throw it from you. Better that one of the parts of your body perish than your whole body to go to hell. Why does Jesus isolate only two parts of the body, the eyes and the hands? Why doesn't he talk here about cutting off your foot? Why doesn't he talk about your nose? Why does he talk about eyes and hands? Very simple. When it comes to sex, here's the standard. You don't look and you don't touch. You do not look, you do not touch. That is God's standard. A look that will stir up a sexual desire within you, or a touch that will stir up a sexual desire within you, you have gone too far. Now some of you will still be tempted to think that that is not fair for God to draw that line. Cosmic killjoy, divine party pooper mentality. And if you are still struggling with that, and you still are not convinced, when I tell you that if you engage in sex outside of marriage, you will succeed in committing sexual suicide, it will destroy you. Suicide. Physical. Moral. And I hope you will understand that when God draws a line and God says no, he's not a party pooper, he's not a cosmic killjoy, God is doing the most loving thing he can possibly do in your life. He's drawing a line and pleading with you and me, saying don't step over it, because if you do, you'll kill yourself. He's not out to ruin your fun, he's out to protect your life. Do you understand? Physical suicide. Moral suicide. Number three. Mental suicide. Mental suicide. It is possible for you to willfully, violently, and ultimately destroy yourself mentally. Mental suicide. Turn to Ephesians chapter 6. Let me show you something very interesting. We're wading through some heavy waters today, right? All right, let's talk about your brain a minute. In Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 11, Paul is talking about spiritual warfare. We are engaged in hand-to-hand combat with an enemy we cannot see, cannot touch. His name is Satan, and he has demonic forces. By the way, do you know how many angels there are? Just a sidelight. This just pops into my mind. Revelation 4 says there are so many angels, it words it this way, thousands upon thousands and 10,000 upon 10,000, which means in the Bible, there are so many angels you cannot count them. And when Lucifer became Satan, one-third of those angels followed him and became demons, which means that there are so many demons, you can't even count them. So statistically, you probably have about 5 to 10 demons riding herd on you all the time. Wow. Don't ever think you're lost in the shuffle. You better know Satan knows you by name. Now let me show you where the battle is waged. All right? Here's the battleground. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 11. Put on the full armor of God, that you may be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. Do you see that little phrase, schemes of the devil? You see that? I traced that through the book of Ephesians. Guess what I discovered? In Ephesians chapter 4, it uses the exact same word, and it uses it in the context of false teaching. False teaching. And this is what it says. Verse 14 of Ephesians 4. As a result, we are no longer to be children, tossed here and there by waves and carried about by every wind of teaching. Now listen, by the trickery of men, by craftiness in deceitful scheming. Scheming, same word. What is the area of battle? Where is the war being fought? What is up for grabs? What is the prize Satan wants to win? Are you ready? Here it is. Satan wants to win the battle as to who is going to control your brain. That is the area of the fight. Your brain. Satan is smart enough and diabolical enough to understand this principle. If he can control the way you think, he will control the way you what? Live. If he can control the way you think, he will control the way you live. Experiments have been done with animals. When an animal is still in an egg, if they can take that egg and put it with a different type of animal and have the thing hatch and that animal grow up with a different kind of animal thinking that it is that animal, it will behave like that animal. Incredible. You've been taught since the time you were in kindergarten you're nothing more than a glorified monkey, and there are a whole lot of people your age living just like monkeys. I mean, there's some truth to that. You are what you eat, the devil says. And so like crazy, you're reading every calorie and you're reading every ingredient, every little deal you put into your stomach. But the Bible comes along and says, oh, no, you're not what you eat. You are what you think. What you think. The battle is on as to who will control your mind. Proverbs chapter 4, verse 23. Guard your brain with all diligence, for out of it flow the issues of life. There is nothing more damaging than a polluted brain. Some of you, I fear, are on the road to permanently polluting your brain. There are only 5 ways information enters your brain. And 2 of those 5 are of primary importance. What you see and what you hear. It is very important that you evaluate everything you deposit in your ears and everything you deposit in your eyes. Because if you succeed in exposing yourself to material, it could be on a TV set, it could be in a theater someplace, it could be a book you read, it could be a magazine, it could be a billboard you look at, it could be a whole lot of things. And every time you permit messages into your brain, you are programming your computer. And it is possible for you to permanently pollute your brain. I had a guy one time in my office, he was 18 years old, and he broke down and wept. I'd never seen anything like it. And I tried to calm him down, and finally when I got him calm, I asked him, why are you so troubled? And he looked at me and he said, every time I look at a girl, I mentally undress her and I can't get victory over it. Polluted brain. A garbage can up here.
And it may take him years to clean that up. What kind of stuff do you look at? What kind of stuff do you listen to? What kind of stuff do you watch? What kind of stuff do you expose yourself to all the time? Do you guard your brain at all? Or do you allow Satan to pour into your brain raw sewage of his corrupted message? Rebellion. Drug abuse. Immorality. And you watch it continually. Violence. Violence. Mark chapter 7, verse 14. After Jesus had called the multitude to him again, he began saying to them, "Listen to me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside of a man which going into him can defile him." He's talking about food. "But that which proceeds out of the man is what defiles the man. If you have ears to hear, listen." And when he left the multitude, he entered the house. His disciples questioned him about the parable, and he said to them, "Are you lacking in understanding also?" And I would ask you the same question. Don't you understand the issues? Don't you understand what's going on behind the scenes? Are you really that naive? I hope not. I hope not. "Do you not understand that whatever goes into a man from outside will not defile him? It does not go into his heart, that is his brain, but into his stomach, and it's eliminated." Thus he declared all foods clean. And he was saying, "That which proceeds out of the man, that is what defiles him. For from within, out of the brain, the heart, proceed evil thoughts." That's first. It always starts as a thought. Every sin you ever committed began as a thought. Don't you understand that? It always began as a thought. And what do those thoughts lead to? You could put evil thoughts, colon, and here are all the results. From within, out of the brain of man, proceeds evil thoughts resulting in fornication, that is sex with someone not married, thefts, murder, adultery, that's sex with someone who is married but not to you. Deeds of coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these things proceed from within and defile the man. And it all begins with your thoughts. Physical suicide, willful, violent, permanent destruction of your body. Moral suicide, willful, violent, permanent destruction of your sexuality. Mental, willful, violent, permanent destruction of your brain. I hope you do not have a polluted brain. If you do, there is only one way to cleanse it. Just one way. If you get mud in the bottom of your swimming pool and you don't have a drain to let it out, there's only one way to purify the pool. If you run enough clean water in the pool, pretty soon you will dilute the garbage until the sewage pours itself out. And the same is true with your brain. Once you have polluted it, there is only one way to cleanse it, and that is to expose yourself to that which is pure. And the only pure information that will do the trick is the Word of God. If you have a problem with a polluted brain, there is only one solution. Read, memorize, and meditate upon the Word of God. The Bible puts it this way in Romans chapter 12, verse 2. "Do not be conformed to this world. Be transformed by the renewing of your" what? Mind. If you want to change your behavior, how do you change it? You change your what? Your mind. If you have bad habits you want to overcome, how do you overcome them? By transforming your what? Your mind. It all begins here. And let me suggest that you begin to evaluate everything you watch, everything you listen to, everything you look at, everything you hear. And would you please have enough integrity and enough guts that if garbage comes on your TV set, you utilize this index finger God gave you and punch the button off. Or at least twist the dial. And please, for the life of you, don't lay your hard-earned money out at some box office someplace to go into a deal and watch raw sewage on that screen. Please, evaluate what you watch. Philippians 4:8, if it is true, if it is pure, if it is lovely, if it has a good reputation, if it is excellent, if it is worthy of praise, think on these things. You want to go to a movie Friday night? No problem. You just make sure it is pure, it is lovely, it is of good reputation, it is excellent, it is worthy of praise. If it's not, forget it. Forget it. You evaluate every show you watch on TV. If it is not worthy of praise, excellent, lovely, of good reputation, shut it off. Shut it off. Physical suicide. Willful, violent, final act of destroying your own body. Moral suicide. Willful, violent, final act of destroying your own morality. Mental suicide. A willful, violent, final act of destroying your own brain. And the fourth kind, spiritual suicide. Spiritual suicide. A willful, violent, final act of destroying your own relationship with Jesus Christ. That is not to say that you can lose your salvation. Don't read more into my statement than is there. I am saying that you can damage permanently your relationship with Christ, never ultimately losing it. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, where you will be saved yet as by fire. You make it into the kingdom, but barely. But all the way through your life, you can severely, permanently damage your walk with Christ. And the way you do that is by willingly exposing yourself to the realm and the power of Satan. Let me put it to you this way, and we'll have to bring it to a close. God actually permits people to be abandoned to satanic influence and destruction. Can I give you another new thought that is even more horrifying than that? It is true that there are times when God will permit certain individuals to be delivered over to Satan for the destruction of their body. But it is even more frightening for me to have to say to you that it is possible if you are guilty of a certain lifestyle, are you ready? Of delivering yourself over to Satan for the destruction of your body. As a Christian, it is possible for you to deliver yourself over to him. Did you know that? The first area is rebellion. Rebellion. When you rebel against those God has placed in authority over you, you have succeeded in opening your life up to satanic influence. 1 Samuel 15:23 says this, rebellion equals the sin of witchcraft. What is the sin of witchcraft? Witchcraft is willingly exposing yourself to the realm and the power of Satan. When you rebel, you have delivered yourself over to the influence of Satan. Do you understand that? Every time you clench a fist and shake it in the face of your mom or dad, authority is a protective covering over you. And every time you shake a fist and rebel, then you have committed the sin of witchcraft. You have exposed yourself to the realm and the power of Satan. Forget God delivering you over to the influence of Satan. That is horrifying enough. But it is even more horrifying for me to think that people like you and people like me could deliver ourselves over to him and not even know it. The second area was the area of satanic entertainment. Satanic entertainment. That could be music. That could be movies. That could be TV shows. That could be books. That could be magazines. Anything that communicates this message. An exaltation of Satan, a mocking of God's name, or a mocking of God's standards. Anything you watch, read, listen to, expose yourself to, that openly mocks God's name, mocks God's standards, or praises Satan, you have exposed yourself to his realm and his power. 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1 talks about seducing spirits and doctrines of demons. And I know why it is such a battle for you. I know why. You cannot resist to lay your money down and walk into that thing or watch people blow each other away. I know why that is such a hold on you. Because 1 Timothy 4:1, it is a seductive demonic spirit. It is a seduction. You are being drawn into it. And something that is seductive, you can't turn your back on it. It is so fascinating. Some of you are addicted to it and can't live without it. Number three, drugs and alcohol. Drugs and alcohol, you get involved in drug use, alcohol in any form. It could be light beer for that matter, any form. You have exposed yourself to the realm and power of Satan. Revelation chapter 9, verse, I believe it is verse 21, where it talks about sorcery. The Greek word is pharmakia. We get the word pharmacy from that word, and it means to become enchanted with, buzzed with, high on, an artificial stimulus. So any chemical you put into your body that stimulates you comes under the category of sorcery. Definite demonic imagery there. Three more and we're out of here. Number four. Sexual activity outside of marriage. We've dealt with that already. Moral suicide. Let me show you its satanic overtones. Romans chapter 1, verse 26. That when you engage in sex outside of marriage, you have believed, quote, the lie. A satanic lie convincing you that you can make your own choices and get away with it. Number five, satanic activities. Distinctively satanic activities. Ouija boards, fortune telling, pendulums, seances, astrology, Dungeons and Dragons, and on it goes. Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 10 to 12. Deuteronomy 18, verses 10 to 12. Some of you say D&D isn't mentioned in Scripture. I'll show it to you. Deuteronomy 18, verse 10. There shall not be found among any of you anyone who makes his son or daughter pass through fire, one who uses divination, one who practices witchcraft, one who interprets omens, or a sorcerer, one who casts spells. What do you do in D&D? Oh, you say, but it's just a game. Oh, no, it's distinctive from every other game. It is a, quote, role-play game. You become the person you're playing. If the character casts a spell, you cast the spell. One who casts a spell calls up a medium, a spiritist, one who calls up the dead, for whoever does these things is detestable to the Lord. And then finally, how do you open yourself up to satanic influence and commit spiritual suicide? You decide to reject Jesus Christ. A rejection of Jesus Christ. Luke chapter 18 and verse 23. If you are not for me, you are against me. We've covered a lot of ground. I hope it has made an impact.